The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the July 30th, 2021 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows a federal agent. He's in a kind of a traditional green uniform with a hat. It says CPB, Border Patrol Federal Agent. He's standing in a doorway. He's got his back to us. He's holding the door open. And outside the door, there's a desert scene, and there's, half a dozen people right at the door. And then as you look beyond them, there are lines of people, just hundreds of them, as far as the eye can see back into the desert scene. The title this week is Border Dilemma: How Many Migrants Can the Biden Administration Afford to Let In? That is one of our main stories, and we will start with that today. Biden under pressure as migrant crisis grows. What happened? Republicans and Democrats were demanding that President Biden take action on immigration this week as migrant arrivals at the southern border hit near record levels and a federal judge ruled against the program that protects some 600,000 young dreamers from deportation. Border agents apprehended more than 188,000 migrants trying to cross illegally from Mexico to the U.S. in June, the highest monthly number in 21 years. Under pressure from progressives and immigration advocates, the Biden administration is considering lifting a pandemic-related public health rule that allows most migrants to be turned back without giving them a chance to apply for asylum. In a letter to the president, 26 Senate Republicans said that ending the order, known as Title 42, would have a dire impact on the crisis already engulfing our southwestern border. The same day the June border figures were released, a federal judge in Texas ruled that President Barack Obama had overstepped his power when he created the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program through executive action in 2012. Judge Andrew Hannon permitted DACA, which allows undocumented immigrants who arrived in the U.S. as children to work and remain here legally, to continue, but shut down approval of new applications. The Biden administration pledged to appeal the decision, which could end up at the Supreme Court. The ruling lent urgency to a Democratic plan to thread immigration measures, including legal protections for DACA recipients, into a $3.5 trillion spending bill that would pass on a party line vote. Unfortunately, in the world we are in, said Senator Debbie Stabenow, Democrat from Michigan, this is our best option. What the editorial said: Democrats' plan to backdoor large-scale amnesty for illegal immigrants is a terrible twofer, said NationalReview.com, ramming through a highly contentious, consequential policy change that wouldn't have a prayer of passing otherwise would be an abuse of Senate rules that limit filibuster-proof reconciliation votes to budgetary matters. On top of that, such a policy would flash another green light to would-be migrants to come here illegally at a moment when our borders are already at a breaking point. Dreamers' futures are once again up in the air, said the Baltimore Sun. Judge Hannon's ruling wasn't based on the worthiness of the program, but rather on matters of process. So tens of thousands of dreamers, many of whom know no other country than the U.S., have been thrust into turmoil because the letters were not dotted and crossed exactly right. Congress must move to protect the dreamers and broaden legal immigration opportunities generally. What the columnist said: The alarming border numbers are yet more proof that Biden's open-door policy has completely redrawn migration patterns, said Paul Bettert in WashingtonExaminer.com. Democrats had claimed that the Biden surge was seasonal and would decline in summer's scorching heat. Instead, the numbers have continued to climb, with officials saying they're on track to make at least 1.5 million apprehensions this fiscal year, which runs from October 2020 through September 2021. That's what happens when you keep telling the world that you're dismantling Trump-era immigration restrictions. The Democrats' reconciliation gambit is risky, and success is far from certain, said Sarah Ferris in Politico.com. The GOP will hammer them for attempting an immigration Hail Mary, and the Senate parliamentarian may not allow it. But for Biden and Democratic lawmakers who need to energize key Latino constituencies in the 2022 midterm, this tactic is likely their best shot at delivering on a decades-long party promise. Biden is caught in a vice, said Nick Miroff and Sean Sullivan in the Washington Post. Trump's harsh immigration policies and rhetoric galvanized both the anti-immigrant right and the pro-immigrant left. Polls show that only 33% of Americans approve of Biden's immigration approach, and the president is acutely aware that the tumult at the border could hurt him politically. He knows the damage this can do, said one former U.S. official, and what a gift this is to Republicans. Controversy of the week. Trump. How close did we come to disaster? Donald Trump's final days in office were even worse than we thought, said Chris Saliza in CNN.com. A raft of new books on the chaotic Trump presidency collectively paint a terrifying picture of a president consumed by personal hatred and volcanic rage over his election defeat, who is willing to use any means necessary to hold on to power. In Frankly, We Did Win This Election by Wall Street Journal reporter Michael Bender, we learned that an infuriated Trump told aides that whoever leaked the fact that he retreated to the White House bunker during Black Lives Matter protest should be hunted down and charged with treason. They should be executed, Trump yelled. Even inside the administration, top aides were deeply worried by Trump's authoritarian impulses, said Ben Jacobs in nymag.com. In I Alone Can Fix It, Carol Leonig and Philip Rucker report that General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, was deeply worried that Trump would invoke the Insurrection Act and likened his lies about a stolen election to the Reichstag fire Adolf Hitler used to seize control of Germany. In the days leading up to January 6th, Milley worked within the Pentagon to develop contingency plans to stop Trump from calling out the military to prevent a peaceful transfer of power. They may try to stage a coup, Milley told aides, but they're not going to effing succeed. Milley is a courageous and honorable man, said Gerald Baker in the Wall Street Journal. But for a general to criticize a recently departed U.S. president in such scathing terms is a grave mistake. His comments sound partisan and will only intensify the sense among millions of Americans that the institutions of their government regard their grievances as treasonous. Another new Trump book, Michael Wolff's Landslide, makes it clear Milley's fears were overblown, said Laura Miller in Slate.com. Trump reacted to his defeat not by calling out the army, but by spewing easily debunked lies about voter fraud and dispatching the ghoulish, sniveling figure of Rudy Giuliani to mount doomed legal challenges. Wolf said most of Trump's aides thought he was off his rocker and put on a show of appeasing him while ignoring his demands. Yes, Trump had tyrannical impulses, but the Mad King was so disorganized, delusional, and incompetent that Wolf concludes that American democracy was never in real danger. Perhaps not, said Susan Glasser in The New Yorker, but that's mainly because of people like Milley. After the election, the general was alarmed that Trump and several Iran hawks in his administration raised the prospect of launching a military strike on Iran before the 45th president left office to punish Tehran for restarting its uranium enrichment program. If you do this, you're going to have a effing war, Milley told the president. Nonetheless, Trump continued to raise the possibility of bombing Iran until January 3rd, when Milley and others finally persuaded him it was too late in his term. These shocking revelations raise a big question, said Julian Zalitzer in CNN.com. Will any of them affect the unshakable and obsequious loyalty of Republican voters and leaders who still see Trump as the head of the GOP? We now have even more evidence that Trump was unhinged and viewed laws, rules, and norms as irrelevant. If Republicans choose to support another Trump run in 2024, it will be crystal clear what they are signing up for. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for sharks after Australia's conservationist and marine biologist called for renaming shark attacks on humans negative encounters to help dispel inherent assumptions that sharks are ravenous, mindless, man-eating monsters. It was a good week for Olympians, who will indeed be able to have sex with one another on the flimsy cardboard beds of Tokyo's Olympic Village. There had been rumors that the beds were designed to prevent intimacy, but the Olympic Committee said the beds can support 441 pounds. It was a good week for switching teams after Donald Trump's former golfing buddy Tom Brady presented President Biden with a number 46 Tampa Bay Buccaneers jersey at the White House ceremony and joked that though he had led the team to a Super Bowl victory, I think about 40% of the people still don't think I won. It was a bad week for jerks on a plane after flight attendants were offered free training on how to subdue unruly airline passengers with eye pokes, double ear slaps, and groin kicks. There have been 3,509 reported passenger incidents this year, most related to a refusal to wear masks. It was a bad week for upbeat music after health officials in Seoul banned gyms from playing music with a tempo faster than 120 beats per minute on the grounds that such music inspires gym-goers to exercise and breathe harder, thus raising the risk of spreading COVID. And finally, it was a bad week for opportunists, with the news that a British man had 10,000 T-shirts printed to support singer Britney Spears in her battle to end her legal conservatorship. Unfortunately for entrepreneur Carl Baxter, the shirts say, #FreeBrittany, which is a province in France. Short and other news piece while we're here. First prison sentence for January 6 rioter. A federal judge sentenced Paul Hodgkins to 8 months in prison this week, the first person sentenced for a felony in the January 6 Capitol insurrection. A crane operator from Tampa, Hodgkins, 38, carried a Trump campaign flag into the Senate chamber, though he did not actively engage in violence. More than 500 rioters have been charged, and in an hours-long hearing in Washington, D.C., District Judge Randolph Moss weighed the impact that Hodgkin's sentence would have on other punishments for other rioters. This was not, by any stretch of the imagination, a protest, Moss said. Prosecutors sought an 18-month term for Hodgkin's, who pleaded guilty and apologized to the court, saying he now recognizes that Joe Biden was legitimately elected. the topic on the briefing this week is Haiti's spiral of misery. The assassination of President Moïse was just the latest calamity to befall Haiti. Why is the country so dysfunctional? Who's in charge? No authority has legitimacy right now in the Western Hemisphere's poorest country. Acting Prime Minister Claude Joseph was nominally left in charge after Jovenel Moïse was gunned down in his home by a hit squad working on behalf of unknown actors. But Joseph, who was appointed by Moïse in April, had little legitimacy, and this week he agreed to transfer power for the good of the nation to Ariel Henry, a 71-year-old neurosurgeon who is being backed by the Core Group, an informal bloc of foreign ambassadors from the EU, the UN, and six nations, including the U.S. Under Moïse's rule, violent gangs had terrorized Haitians, killing dozens and engaging in kidnapping and rape. Now the country is in turmoil, with Haitians afraid to leave their homes. Joseph has asked the U.S. to deploy troops to protect critical infrastructure, but previous U.S. interventions have failed, and President Biden said that while Marines would protect the U.S. embassy, sending troops is not on the agenda. Who colonized Haiti? France first colonized the western third of the island of Hispaniola that became Haiti. Unlike the Spanish, who ruled what became the Dominican Republic in the east, the French denuded the land, cutting down nearly all the trees for timber. French colonizers also wiped out the indigenous Taino people and brought in hundreds and thousands of enslaved Africans to work on sugar and coffee plantations under brutal conditions. The enslaved people revolted and pushed out the French in 1804. But in its settlement with France, Haiti had to pay 150 million francs in reparations for the loss of slaves, an impossible sum, 10 times what the U.S. had just paid Napoleon for the Louisiana Purchase. Haitians borrowed from French banks and spent a century toiling not to build infrastructure, but to pay that debt. In 1915, fearing that the Germans would take Haiti over to establish a Caribbean base, President Woodrow Wilson sent in troops to protect U.S. business interests. The U.S. occupied the country until 1934. Did the occupation help Haiti? No, it was devastating. The U.S. confiscated Haiti's gold reserves, imposed racial segregation and forced labor, and created a gendarmerie controlled by Marines. American authorities consolidated Haiti's debt to France, but replaced it with debt to U.S. banks. Haitians repeatedly rebelled against foreign occupation, and the U.S. responded with violence, killing 2,000 protesters in just one skirmish. When the U.S. finally gave up and pulled out, it left a desperately poor and unstable nation. In the 1950s, the U.S. feared that Haiti would turn communist, so Washington supported the ruthless Duvalier regime of dictators Papa Doc and Baby Doc. The Duvaliers looted Haiti of hundreds of millions of dollars and disappeared some 30,000 people with death squads trained by the U.S. In 1990, Haiti finally got a democratically elected president, former priest Jean-Bertrand Aristide, but he was deposed in coups in 1991 and 2004. And both times, the U.S. military intervened with U.S. approval. The political chaos was compounded by a series of natural disasters. Why so many disasters? Haiti lies on an earthquake fault and smack in the middle of hurricane zone, so it has been pummeled by a series of quakes and floods that keep wiping out whatever Haitians managed to build. The first decade of this century saw 15 such disasters. In 2010, a magnitude 7.0 earthquake killed nearly 250,000 people and left at least 1.5 million homeless. When the UN sent peacekeepers for relief effort, They brought a cholera epidemic with them that killed some 10,000 people, mostly children, and sickened hundreds of thousands. And when international donors pledged $16 billion to help rebuild, they found no reliable authority to distribute the aid, and less than $3 billion was actually spent. Most of it went to international workers or fueled corruption. Who has governed since? In 2011, Haitians elected Michel Martelly, a pop singer with no political experience, but with the explicit backing of U.S. government. He and other Haitian leaders were accused of embezzling and mismanaging some $2 billion in loans from Venezuela's Petrocaribe, and his tenure was marked by near-constant protest. He tapped Moissa, a banana exporter, to succeed him. With a shaky claim on power, Moissa used violence to repress opponents, and he was widely detested. What happens next? American officials fear a repeat of the boat people exodus of the 1970s, when tens of thousands of Haitians fled Baby Doc's repression and reached Florida by boat. U.S. and foreign diplomats are pressing Henry to form a unity government of several factions until elections can be held. Jonathan Katz, a journalist who has reported extensively on Haiti, says the U.S. must let Haitians choose their next leader and not force on them someone from the corrupt class of politicians the U.S. has spent decades elevating. And it's time for a few of the best columns of the week. We'll start with two from the U.S. How to fix a broken court. Lifetime tenure is not essential to judicial independence or democratic government, says Wallace Jefferson and Ruth McGregor in NBCNews.com. So let's get rid of it. After Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, 83, indicated in an interview last week that he's unlikely to retire before the court's next term, frantic progressives tried to shame him into stepping down so President Biden could replace him with another liberal. Timed retirements are just one cost of the intense politicization of the nation's highest court. Interest groups who demand fealty to a specific judicial philosophy or ideology now dominate the nomination process, with nominees picked for reasons other than their judgment, demeanor, and wisdom. The fact that new justices can serve decades, often into their 80s, makes the stakes for each nomination even greater. That's why Congress should set 18-year terms for Supreme Court justices, which would give each president a set number of picks per term. Limiting terms would reduce some of the frenzied politicking when a justice retires or dies. The Supreme Court nomination process has become dysfunctional, and given the outsized role the court plays in our system of governance, it desperately needs reform. The hottest summer of our lives. It's almost as if the entire East Coast has shifted south, said David Lenhart. As the cascading effects of climate change become more apparent with every passing month, average summer high temperatures in cities from Portland, Maine to Atlanta are climbing 3 to 4 degrees and are coming to resemble those of cities hundreds of miles to the south. Portland's July average temperature, 78 degrees in 1970, has risen to Boston's old average in the low 80s, while Boston's is now like New York City's, which has become like Philadelphia's a decade ago. While Philly's average is nearly 90, is like Washington, D.C.'s old average. The nation's capital is now hotter than Atlanta, and both cities now have Tampa's old July average in the low 90s. The same phenomenon is occurring in Mountain West cities like Billings, Montana, Denver and Salt Lake City. In Montana and Idaho, daily highs topped 100 degrees this week. This summer is on track to be the hottest on record, and the extreme heat is creating situations that are a mix of unnatural and horrific, with dozens of wildfires now exploding throughout the West. Climate change is already making our weather more uncomfortable and more dangerous, and our future is increasingly precarious. This is an international column. Afghanistan. Taliban find a partner in China. Beijing has spotted an opportunity in the U.S.'s abandonment of Afghanistan to de facto Taliban control, said Stephanie Finlay in the Financial Times. American and NATO troops will be gone within a month, and various factions in the war-torn country, the Taliban, the Afghan government, and the northern warlords, are all tussling for power. But the Taliban, who already control more than half of Afghanistan's districts, are ascendant. U.S. analysts believe they will take over Kabul within 6 months. China is preparing for such a future and may become the next superpower to try to write a chapter in Afghanistan's history. China and Afghanistan share only a small border, but that 56-mile frontier runs along the western edge of Xinjiang province, home to China's Muslim Uyghur minority. Beijing's key foreign policy goal in Afghanistan is to ensure that the Taliban don't take up the cause of the Uyghurs, whose culture Beijing is trying to obliterate through mass concentration camps and forced sterilization. Beijing is now offering to rebuild Afghanistan's shattered infrastructure, and in return, the Taliban have pledged not to host Uyghur separatist fighters as they did in years past. It's in Beijing's interest to ensure a stable and prosperous Afghanistan, said Qingling Lo in the South China Morning Post. China is investing some $60 billion in the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which will connect Xinjiang to Pakistan's Gwadar port on the Arabian Sea through a network of roads, railways, and pipelines. An unstable Afghanistan would jeopardize that flagship project. Beijing is also eyeing Afghanistan's mineral wealth. The country has an estimated $1 trillion worth of untapped copper, iron, cobalt, mercury, gold, and lithium reserves, as well as valuable coal and gas fields. Some Chinese argue that we should shun the Taliban, calling them an enemy of China's national interest, said Hu Zijin in Global Times. Such a claim is emotional, naive, and deeply out of place. We cannot interfere in Afghanistan's internal affairs by supporting or opposing one faction. If the Taliban take charge, we will work with them. Only last week, Taliban spokesman Suhail Shaheen said the group regards China as a welcome friend and hopes to talk to Beijing about investments as soon as possible. Is the West just going to let China inveigle its way in to fill the void left by the U.S.? Asked the Australian in an editorial. China already has far too much influence over enormously indebted neighboring Pakistan. Prime Minister Imran Khan, who routinely calls for action against Islamophobia, recently said he accepts Beijing's line that Muslims are not being brutalized in Xinjiang. If China also gains control of Afghanistan, it will upset the entire power balance in South Asia, which is currently dominated by democratic India. The West might think that bringing the troops home will draw a line under the unwanted fervor war, forever war in Afghanistan. China's cynical attempt to cozy up to the Taliban for the sake of gaining strategic advantage suggests otherwise. Our in-depth article, The Last Word, is titled this week, Dying of Denial. The Delta variant and vaccine resistance have brought the coronavirus roaring back to Springfield, Missouri, said Fennett Nirapil in the Washington Post. As younger people put off vaccines, their families often pay the price. The worst of the pandemic seemed behind Mercy Hospital. Those weeks last winter when the coronavirus wards were full of people struggling to breathe. But after months of reprieve, the virus has come roaring back, sending unvaccinated young adults and middle-aged patients from across southwest Missouri there in droves as the highly transmissible Delta variant tears through the region. The hospital in Springfield, Missouri has been treating more than 130 COVID-19 patients each day since last week, more than the winter surge, and had to open a sixth ward. It came close to running out of ventilators earlier this month. We're just very disheartened. This was all pretty avoidable, said Wanda Brown, a nurse unit manager. Last year, we were looking forward to the vaccine coming out because we really thought that was going to be helpful for our community. We feel like we've taken giant leaps backward. Springfield, a city of 170,000 nestled in the Ozarks, has become a cautionary tale for how the more transmissible Delta variant, now estimated to account for half of all new cases nationwide, can ravage poorly vaccinated communities and return them to the darkest days of the pandemic. Missouri has reported one of the nation's highest per capita increases in new coronavirus cases in recent weeks. Freeman Health Systems in Joplin, about 70 miles west of Springfield, announced the full reopening of its COVID-19 ward in late June after downsizing in the spring because of lack of patients. Experts fear that the surge in Springfield, known as the birthplace of Bass Pro Shops and Andy's Frozen Custard, is a harbinger of tensions to come as people play down the pandemic and refuse to get vaccinated, even in the face of overwhelmed hospitals and preventable death. Instead of unifying the community, the surge has hardened divisions, unleashing anger from healthcare workers fed up with vaccine misinformation, and exposing deep antipathy toward the public health establishment. New infections are rapidly rising to levels not seen since early January, prompting the school system to reinstate a mask mandate for summer school. Almost every virus sample sequenced in June turned out to be the Delta variant, which is significantly more transmissible than the strain that first arrived in the United States. Local health officials are trying to create an alternate care site for stable COVID-19 patients as hospitalizations hit an all-time peak of 231 on July 15th and are projected to surge beyond available capacity. Coronavirus deaths in Greene County, where Springfield is located, had plunged this spring, but 23 people have succumbed since June 21st. The fire chief described the outbreak as a mass casualty event happening in slow motion. Caitlin Mozingo, a 19-year-old rising sophomore at Springfield-based Missouri State University, carries the guilt of almost certainly infecting her mother. Mozingo, who has severe allergies to nuts and certain medications, held off on a shot until after a July 20th appointment with her allergist to discuss the potential risks of vaccines. Her mother, Leanne Mozingo, 48, also waited, worried about side effects as a result of her complicated medical history, including ailments her doctors couldn't diagnose. But the coronavirus came home after Caitlin contracted a mild case after hanging out with a friend who also tested positive. Leanne wore a mask as she brought her daughter vegan chicken strips and would disinfect the bathroom regularly with Lysol. After her daughter recovered, Leanne's throat began to ache. She started regularly using oxygen she would normally only use at night for her sleep apnea. After waking up in the middle of the night, screaming for help because she couldn't breathe, Leanne was taken to a hospital by ambulance. Within days, she was on a ventilator. Caitlin hoped her mother would persevere, as she had done through several bouts of depression and anxiety, stomach surgery, chronic pulmonary obstructive disorder, endometriosis, and other chronic pain. She embraced her sedated mother one last time on June 27th before doctors removed the ventilator. Her brother, DJ, who has autism and relied on his mother as a primary caregiver, watched their mother die on FaceTime from the hospital parking lot, unable to step inside because he was also infected. I keep on telling everyone she's going to come home in a week, and we are going to be a big family again, Caitlin Mozingo said. We as young people don't understand, because we feel like we are healthy, and next thing you know, you get it, and you give it to your mom, and she passes. Doctors and nurses are fighting to overcome the perception that young adults do not need to worry about contracting the virus when they see evidence to the contrary every day. I'm seeing some people in their 30s and 40s that don't have underlying health conditions, and they are very ill with this, said Howard Jarvis, the emergency room medical director at Cox Health South. And sometimes they're not so ill that they have to be admitted. They may be back in 3 or 5 days and do need to be admitted. Cox Health, which is locally owned, and the other major hospital in Springfield, publicized videos of bedside interviews of COVID-19 patients urging people to get vaccinated, and posted about a man in his 40s who told nurses he wished he had been vaccinated before he was intubated and later died. But those posts also unleashed comments from people doubting the severity of the surge. The skepticism isn't all online. One of Jarvis's patients initially refused to get tested for the coronavirus, relenting only after other tests ruled out other illnesses. Jarvis still hears the occasional insistence about the false claim that vaccines contain tracking microchips. Fed up, Cox Health Chief Executive Steve Edwards, a frequent social media presence, tweeted July 1st, "If you are making wildly disparaging comments about the vaccine and have no public health expertise, you may be responsible for someone's death. Shut up." That tweet won praise from people seeking catharsis when anti-vaccine voices have been loud and belligerent, but it also unleashed a backlash. Nick Reed, a local conservative radio talk show host, devoted a show the next day to Edwards' tweet. He said the message would erode community trust further and make patients with legitimate concerns about side effects more wary of getting honest answers from doctors at Cox Health. Edwards stood by his tweet, which he said was clearly targeting people spreading false information and not those concerned about side effects. "This is my hometown. I don't treat it as a job. When I've been in our COVID ICU, I've seen people I know, and it breaks my heart," Edwards said in an interview. "I really don't care about any kind of backlash I get by speaking the words that I do that I think will save lives." The CDC has deployed 2 staff members to assist in Springfield's coronavirus response, including one focused on improving the communications strategy for vaccine holdouts. A major barrier is conservative reluctance in a county that Trump won by 20 percentage points and by even broader margins in the neighboring rural counties. A recent Washington Post ABC poll found that nearly half of Republicans probably will not get their shots, and that the Midwest is the most vaccine-averse region, with 27% saying they definitely will not get vaccinated. Some Republican politicians have been vocal in urging their constituents to get vaccinated. They've been more muted in Missouri, where Governor Mike Parson has described vaccination as a personal responsibility, and said healthcare leaders need to stop trying to scare people into taking vaccines. He also instructed the state health department not to cooperate with the Biden administration on door-to-door vaccine outreach, even though local health authorities have been canvassing homes. Deep skepticism about the latest outbreak was on display outside the Bass Pro Shops complex that draws customers from around the region to buy fishing supplies and guns in a sprawling store that has zoo-like enclosures with alligators and turtles. Several shoppers who declined to give their names described the reports about the Delta variant outbreak as overblown, exaggerated, and a crock of blank. One woman said her daughter was hospitalized in an intensive care unit with COVID-19, but that she thinks the numbers are exaggerated. Others took more measured views, such as Billy and Alyssa Eorg, a couple from nearby Sparta, Missouri. Alyssa, who is 24 and pregnant with her second child, declined to get vaccinated because she wasn't sure how the shots would affect the pregnancy. Billy, 26, didn't see the rush for himself. "It's no worse than the flu," he said of the virus, which experts say appears to be far more contagious and deadly than the flu. For some young people who haven't made up their minds about the vaccines, it's already too late. Olivia Bricker, 21, drove to the health department offices for a throat swab after feeling her head throb. Several co-workers at her retail job tested positive for the virus, as did her 25-year-old live-in boyfriend, who felt like a sack of potatoes. They are not anti-vaccine. He previously had the virus. Bricker hadn't gotten around to getting vaccinated, unsure of which of the three authorized vaccines to choose, and didn't feel much urgency because older relatives she feared infecting had been immunized. "I feel like it's one of those things I probably should have done instead of waiting." Facing the prospect of many young people still feeling relatively safe from the virus, vaccine proponents are trying to urge them to protect their elders and friends who have pre-existing conditions and may not be as lucky. Caitlin Mozingo thinks about that social responsibility as she prepares to return to campus, where many of her classmates are in no hurry to get vaccinated. On a Friday evening, Leanne Mozingo's family gathered in the home where wilted flowers rested on the mantle and grief started to give way for planning life without her. DJ, 22, who has struggled to process the loss of his mother and biggest support system, has been turning more to his grandmother, sister, and his mother's longtime boyfriend, Justin Brown, as he navigates adulthood with autism. The family needs to find a new home, unable to pay the $1,400 rent without Leanne's disability payments. They plan to hold a garage sale to downsize and raise money for a move. Brown unenthusiastically got his shots after his employer offered 2 hours of pay for each dose. "I just kind of thought COVID in general was a joke, and you hear stories about how it had a 97% survival rate," said Brown, 27. "I was around COVID in the thick of it for the better part of 30 days, and I'm vaccinated and never got a single symptom." He added, "Maybe you're getting chipped or all those other conspiracies they're talking about, but at the end of the day, it's clearly doing something." A version of this article first appeared in the Washington Post. Here's a couple of pieces from the health and science page. How the climate has shaped our bodies. Humans have fluctuated in size significantly over the past million years because of changes in the climate, a new study suggests. Researchers took measurements from more than 300 fossils from the Homo genus, the family to which modern-day humans, Homo sapiens, belong. They then calculated the regional climate experienced by each of these hominins when they were alive. Climate, and in particular temperature, was found to be the main driver of changes in body size. In cold, harsh climates, body size was larger, while warmer climates were linked to smaller bodies. Larger bodies can buffer individuals from cold temperatures. The larger you are, the smaller your surface compared to your volume. so you can serve heat more efficiently, co-author Andrea Monica from the University of Cambridge tells CNN.com. This relationship between climate and body mass can be seen in the animal kingdom. Polar bears in the Arctic, for example, weigh more than brown bears in the warmer climes. And it applies broadly to modern humans. The average Dutch man is 6 feet tall, whereas the average Indian man is 5'5". The researchers found no association between temperature and brain size. Because humans evolve over many generations, the researchers say, it will take thousands of years for our bodies to change in response to global warming on the current course. Even then, the changes will be small, about 2 pounds per 3.6 degrees of warming, Manica says. We're not going to shrink tomorrow. A rethink on asthma. When the coronavirus first appeared, many doctors worried that the pandemic would be equally perilous for people with asthma. But that feared surge in asthma attacks never occurred. In fact, research from England, Scotland, and South Korea found big drops in hospital and doctors' visits for the chronic condition. Now the new U.S. study of 1,201 asthma patients has found that the number of attacks suffered by participants fell 40% after lockdowns kicked in. We know this isn't reluctance to go to the emergency room, co-author Elliot Israel from Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston tells The Atlantic. This is a true, real decrease. Why this drop-off happened remains unclear. But it was larger among those who normally worked outside the home, 65%, than those who already worked at home, 23%. Doctors say this suggests that allergens at home, such as pets and secondhand smoke, may play a much smaller part in asthma than thought. That, in turn, could mean that triggers such as cold and flu viruses, which almost vanished during the pandemic because of masking, social distancing, and other measures, play a bigger part in the condition. How sea otters stay warm. Scientists have long known that sea otters run hot. Lacking the layer of blubber that insulates whales and polar bears, they generate heat with a metabolic rate 3 times faster than any other creature of their size. Yet exactly how sea otters do this has always been a mystery. Until now. A new study has determined that the animal's warming secret lies in the mitochondria in their muscle cells. When mitochondria, often called the powerhouses of cells, break down sugar to extract energy, protons pop through a membrane via tiny spining spores. When the protons are too numerous for the spores to handle, they seep across the membrane in other ways, producing lots of heat in the process. In a lab test, the researchers found that sea otters experience significantly more proton leak than any other animal tested, including Iditarod sled dogs. And while metabolic capacity is usually linked to activity level, sea otters have the same high rate whether they're being active or not. That heat generation, Trevor Wright from Texas A&M University tells the New York Times, is really the driving force of their metabolic development. And we'll flip over to the Talking Points page with another Delta variant article. The Delta outbreak, who's to blame? Susan Johnson of Mountain Home, Arkansas, declined a COVID-19 vaccination this spring, figuring she was protected as long as she never left her house without a mask. Linda Marion, 68, feared the vaccine might actually give her COVID, while Barbara Billingmeyer, 74, decided she didn't need a shot because I never get sick. Last week, all three women were patients at an Arkansas hospital's COVID overflow ward, said Sharon Lanfrenier in the New York Times. Johnson required supplemental oxygen for 10 days. Billingmeyer said she was terrified to discover you can't breathe, while Marion said she was so sick, I felt like I couldn't take it and wanted to die. But despite their severe illness, none of the three changed their minds about vaccination. It's just too new, Billingmeyer said. It is like an experiment. As a result of vaccine skepticism like theirs and the highly infectious Delta variant, The national daily average of new cases tripled over the past month, surging to 35,000 this week. Former FDA Chief Dr. Scott Gottlieb said the U.S. might be vastly underestimating the actual numbers of the infected, warning that most people who aren't vaccinated, including young adults, will get this Delta variant. Vaccination rates have hit a wall of skepticism, especially in rural America, said Michael Brendan Doherty in NationalReview.com. Elites are convinced that these people must all be morons, but many skeptics are making a risk-benefit calculation that makes sense to them. COVID, they correctly say, is rarely fatal, especially for those under 60. Some feel the risk of getting COVID as an act of God is easier to accept than the unknown risk of a vaccine that they did consciously choose to take. Unfortunately, attempts to change their minds about vaccines backfire because they are poisoned by condescension. Let's try leveling with skeptics, conceding that yes, there aren't long-term studies on the vaccines, even if they do seem very safe so far. Blaming experts and liberals is ridiculous, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. Americans are refusing to get the vaccine mainly because of a right-wing death cult consisting of Fox News, anti-vaxxers on social media, and cynical Republican politicians who are actively discouraging vaccination to own the libs. Representative Lauren Boebert, Republican from Colorado, for example, mockingly calls COVID vaccine the Fauci ouchie and tweeted that the easiest way to make the Delta variant go away is to turn off CNN. Anti-vax disinformation spreads like wildfire on social media, and President Biden hit the nail on the head last week when he said Facebook, by spreading disinformation, is effectively killing people. Remember how Democrats spoke of the vaccine when Donald Trump was president? Asked Byron York in WashingtonExaminer.com. They recklessly accused the Trump administration of pressuring the FDA to rush the approval process. During the vice presidential debate, Kamala Harris said, "If Donald Trump tells us that we should take it, I'm not taking it." In a polarized nation, vaccination was bound to generate partisan suspicion. And if Trump had been reelected, it would be Democrats refusing to roll up their sleeves. The Biden administration made the early mistake of promising miracles in defeating COVID, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. And now they're blaming red states and tech officials for the predictable fact that vaccination will not be universal. The country needs to accept that some COVID cases will persist for the foreseeable future and that we have to live with it without shutting down the economy. There is a simple way to dramatically increase vaccination rates, said Matthew Iglesias in slowboring.com. The FDA needs to give full approval to the vaccines, which currently have only emergency use authorization. Vaccine skeptics cite that as proof that these are experimental vaccines, even though more than 150 Americans are fully vaccinated with minimal side effects and astonishing levels of effectiveness. Once the FDA approves the vaccines, major institutions such as the military, private universities, and school districts in blue states could impose mandates, and vaccination could become mandatory for international travel. Full approval makes it easier for employers to require vaccination, too. It's important to remember that many conservatives live in social circles where COVID is viewed as hysteria driven by panicky libs, and that refusing to wear masks and get the vaccine is a heroic act of courage. But if you get the shot not because you're afraid of COVID, but because you have to in order to work, go to school, leave the country, or attend big indoor events, you've got a good excuse. So, FDA, let's give those folks the excuse they need. And we've got time for a few of the shorter pieces here. Starting with gun-related injuries in the U.S. incur more than $1 billion in annual medical cost, most of it paid by Medicaid and other public health programs, according to a study by the Government Accounting Office. Gun violence leads to 50,000 emergency room visits and 30,000 hospital stays a year, with many of the victims poor and uninsured. Four states have accounted for more than 40% of all new COVID infections over the past week. Florida is responsible for nearly 20% of the nation's new COVID cases and now has four times the average of all states for new cases per day. Heat spells, drought, wildfires, and smoke damage wreaked havoc on grape crops in Napa County, California last year, reducing sales of red wine grapes from $829 million in 2019 to $384 million. If the extreme heat and drought continues in wine country, all of us are out of business, said Cyril Chapelet, president of Chapelet Winery. On the poll watch, 20% of Americans believe that it is definitely true or probably true that the government is using the COVID-19 vaccine to microchip the population. And we'll finish out with a quote from Angelica Houston, who says, "I have this terrible theory that people are like roaches. They adapt to their circumstances." Well, with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of today's program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.